Just a second, please.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Folletti. I represent the appellant in this case, Dr. Aaron Marlowe. The appellee is CSF, Inc., or Flint Construction. This is an appeal from the Circuit Court of the City of Suffolk. A brief statement of the facts is that Dr. Marlowe and Flint Construction entered into a contract in February of 2011 for construction of a pier at Dr. Marlowe's property in Suffolk, Virginia. The original contract provided that that contract would be completed within a reasonable period of time, approximately 6 weeks or so. However, for a number of reasons, the construction was delayed, whether it was delays in getting a permit, employees of the contractor who had injury, or other factors that delayed the completion of the work by Flint until August of 2011. From February of 2011 until August, there were a number of modifications to the written contract. One included an extension of the pier, one included the installation of ski lifts. The one at issue for purposes of today's argument is a modification that provided that cross bolts or stringer bolts would be installed in the pier to make it more structurally sound. This was a request that Dr. Marlowe made on July 16, 2011. He did that in an email message to Mr. Flint, and Mr. Flint responded and said, "No problem, essentially, we can do that. Henry will be back in a couple of weeks," Henry being the supervisor of the project. "It will be completed at the time the contract is completed. Don't worry about it." I'm paraphrasing, but that's more or less what the contract modification provided. Work proceeded on the pier, and then on August 14th, Dr. Marlowe sent an email to Mr. Flint inquiring about another matter, but also commenting, "Please add the cost of the cross bolts onto the contract." Mr. Flint at that point in time responded, "Sorry, impossible to do that work at this time, more or less. You know, we're unable to perform. You can't drill through metal," something or words to that effect. Dr. Marlowe, there was some discussion between the parties. Essentially what happened, though, is 12 days later, Tropical Storm Irene, first hurricane, now Tropical Storm Irene comes through and damages over 100 feet of Dr. Marlowe's pier. The evidence of court suggests that the piers adjacent to Dr. Marlowe's property that had been cross-bolted suffered no damage. Now, at issue in this case, and the assignment of error involves whether or not the trial court erred as a matter of law in finding that there was no contract modification for the request for the installation of stringer or cross bolts. What we do know is that almost a month occurred. There was an express agreement by Mr. Flint in the exchange of these emails to perform under the contract, to install those cross bolts. I believe it is clear from the email exchange that that was certainly the intent of Mr. Flint, and it could not have been more clearly communicated to Dr. Marlowe. Mr. Flint, though a month later, says it's impossible to do.
Wait, let me stop you a second. There had been some other modifications, I think, from the original written contract. And I think probably they started out either oral request or email request. And at some point, if I recall correctly, and please tell me if I'm wrong about this, CSF would provide a new bill that showed what it was going to cost, or there'd be something of some sort reduced to writing with regard to that modification. We don't have any of that here, do we?
We do not in this instance. And I can tell you that a look at the facts and the conduct of the parties, there were certain appendixes that were performed or prepared by Mr. Flint after other contract modifications. But take a look at the contract modification for the extension of the pier by, I believe, 20 feet. That agreement was reached in June, I believe June 20th of 2011, and was not reduced to an appendix until sometime in August. almost 2 months later. And even Mr. Flint at trial testified that it wasn't his practice to prepare written appendixes or amendments to the contract right away. He stated that in his trial testimony.
But in this case, we do have, a month later or some amount of time later, CSF coming back and saying, it's too late, I can't do it.
Correct. And I would submit that their reasons for not being able to do it have never been clearly explained and are not justified. A clear look at the facts.
I guess my point is, based on the party's conduct, this 1 month later was not out of the what they had been doing, because as you just pointed out, in one situation it was 2 or 3 months later before we got the appendix. So,
Dr. Marlowe had specifically requested at that point in time that it be added to the contract. And clearly there was never any question up until this point in time as to whether Dr. Marlowe could pay.
I mean, I guess it seems to me your argument is based upon the party's conduct in the past, and it seems to me like the conduct here didn't quite meet what the conduct had been in the past with regard to when there was a contract modification.
It should not.
And that's
part of my argument.
Then how can we say that the court erred in finding there wasn't a modification?
Well, there was a modification, Your Honor. I mean, and I don't think that the conduct of the parties at the time that Mr. Flint refused to... The intent of the parties on July 16th, the agreement of the parties, was that they would... that Mr. Flint would perform. He would provide the stringer bolts. And at no point in time in that 28 or 30 days did he ever communicate to Dr. Marlowe that it was impossible to do it. In fact, he was never on the site to tell Dr. Marlowe that. And his supervisor, who was on the site, who was supposed to be doing the work, returned to the job on July 21st, according to his own testimony, and testified that Mr. Flint never once told him that there had been this agreed modification to the contract. So work proceeded on that pier for a period of 23 days when Mr. Flint was not there nor had ever communicated to his supervisor that this work was to be performed. And so when 28 days passes and the contract cannot be performed, according to Mr. Flint, he breached the contract by not performing pursuant to the contract. And the fact
well, we've
that
got
there
to first decide.
Before
we can say he breached, we've got to establish that there was indeed an enforceable modification.
Well, I don't think we need something in writing. I don't think there was any question that there had been other modifications, and certainly Mr. Flynn is not arguing that there had not been previous modifications.
But that's my point. The conduct here was not the same as the conduct of the parties when they made those other modifications.
I would disagree. I would say the conduct is the same, because the contract was never to prepare a modification the next day or the next week. The modification, the written appendix, always followed by a month or two. And in fact, that's explicitly what Dr. Marlowe requested. Give me a written appendix.
Does the record show in those other instances whether the work was done before the written appendix was submitted or after?
I'm not sure it does, Your Honor. I know that the work and the construction of the pier, the extension of the pier, took some time. It was most likely, it was certainly completed before the modification, the appendix for the extension of the pier. That work was certainly completed before the appendix.
Does the record show that?
It does, Your Honor.
All right.
The installation of the ski lifts, I believe that work was performed as well. But there was never an instance there where Dr. Marlowe had to question whether or not the work was going to be performed. And in this instance, there was. The point is that when one party agrees in writing to do something, and I believe the law is clear on this, that a modified contract existed at that time.
Let me switch gears on you. What's your proof of damages in this case?
Damages are whatever damages naturally flow from Mr. Flint's material breach of the modified contract.
Now, what was your proof of that in this case?
What was
your proof? What was your evidence?
The further evidence was the testimony of Chuck Archer, who was the contractor who did the repair work on the pier.
Well, he gave the amount that it cost him to do, repair the pier after the hurricane, right?
It was the cost to repair the pier, which had been the whole basis for the contract, was for Flint to construct a structurally sound pier.
Well, I understand, but I know what it cost to fix it after the hurricane. But I couldn't find evidence that said that the damage would not have occurred if these bolts had been in place.
There was plenty of circumstantial evidence that this damage would not have occurred had it not been, or had Flint put in the cross bolts as requested by Dr. Martin.
There's only circumstantial evidence? There's no direct evidence of that? No testimony?
There's no direct evidence of that, Your Honor. In fact, I'm not sure there really could be.
Okay.
I mean, I think in this instance you have to go with the fact that there are other properties with piers that have cross-bolting adjacent to Dr. Marlowe's property that sustained no damage.
Well, I don't know a lot about piers, obviously, from where I live, but does the piers, their stability have anything to do with how deep the pilings are?
It can.
Or whether they're in a cove as opposed to being on open water?
It can. All I'm saying, and again, there is no direct evidence, nor do I think there can ever be direct evidence, that cross-bolting or not cross-bolting would have absolutely prevented damage.
So you're saying you can't prove your damages? There's no way you could prove your damages?
There is circumstantial evidence.
Counsel, there's not a forensic engineer who could not come back and look at that and opine?
There are so many factors that are involved in that issue, and a lot of them, as have been pointed out, might be the location of the pier, the depth of the pilings. There are many factors, but what Dr. Marlowe wanted, and he's an engineer himself through training, he wanted cross-bolting because he knew that his neighbors had not experienced any structural damage.
But I guess my question is, why would that essential fact tying the damage to the alleged cause not be not require expert testimony? It's certainly not within my knowledge as a learned individual. It would seem that an expert witness would have to tie those facts together.
Well, the best expert testimony, at least, that was offered on that issue was the testimony of Chuck Archer, who repaired the pier, and essentially testifying that he always installs cross bolts, and that none of the piers that he had constructed in the area that had cross bolting experienced any damage.
But he was not qualified as an expert, is that correct?
That is correct.
So was he capable of giving that opinion? Well, never mind that question.
There were no experts offered at trial to render an opinion on that very issue by either side.
Okay.
Again, we believe that a contract modification did occur, that a material breach occurred when Mr. Flint refused to perform under the modified contract. We believe that the General District Court Judge, Judge Bates, accurately assessed the evidence and the law in this case in finding for Dr. Marlowe at the General District Court level, and that the Circuit Court Judge erred in finding that there was no modified contract. We believe that this contract was breached, that Dr. Marlowe was justified in terminating the contract, and that under the decision of Horton v. Horton, that the non-breaching party, or the breaching party in this instance, is not entitled to seek enforcement of the contract and should not be entitled to damages nor attorney fees, interest, as he was awarded at the trial court level.
Let me ask you one final question. From your view of the trial court's finding, as he stated it from the bench, did the court rule with regard to the issue of damages? Because it seemed to me like he did on page 252, that he said, insofar as damages then from the alleged damages from that failure to put in cross bolts is concerned, I think the court would have to rule that there's pause against the doctor in that case. I read that as a finding that, and besides, you didn't bring your damages.
Your Honor, I had a little difficulty hearing you.
I'm sorry. Look on page 252. Joint Appendix, line 16. It seems to me that paragraph is a ruling from the trial court that you also did not prove your damages.
Well, Your Honor, that may be the trial judge's opinion, but I think there was clear evidence in the record.
Well, my point is, if the court did find that you had not proven damages, I don't believe there's an assignment of error that challenges that finding.
There is not, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
That concludes my argument.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, my name is Roger Griffin. It's my pleasure today to represent CSF, Inc., known as Flint Marine Traders, Flint Marine in the southern Tidewater area of Virginia Beach. Your Honors, Mr. Pelletti has set forth the facts in this case fairly well, but I think there's three important facts that bring us to what the Court can initially decide this case on, that there was no binding modification of this contract. The parties had not agreed upon a price to be negotiated for this additional work. Secondarily, the implication of the facts is, and the implied facts are, that even after the work wasn't done, a month later when the email came through from my client that it's going to be impossible for us to do that work, Dr. Marlowe's actions showed that he didn't have any binding contract in his mind because he, number one, said, so that's a shame. I think it would have been nice, but if you can give me a warranty, that may take care of it. And later on in that very same email, he said, I've received your invoice. I'm happy. I will pay for the work. He nowhere said, but oh, by the way, we have a deal. I want you to, I'm going to enforce that deal, and I want those stringer bolts put in. And then thirdly is, the main fact is that this is all about the hurricane, really. In the contract in this case for my client, dismisses any warranty for hurricane, storm damage, anything of that sort. So where this comes about first is as to the mutual assent. There's no price guarantee. In the trial of the case, I specifically asked Dr. Bombo, had Mr. Flint come back to you and said, this work can be done, but you know what? It's a real pain for my guys to do it because we've nailed in this stuff, which the facts were. We don't want to drill through our nails. We're going to ruin nail bits. It's going to be a pain. We've got to refloat structures back out there to stand on. It's $10,000. Dr. Marlowe testified, I wouldn't have paid it. He said, there's some price I would have reached a maximum that I wouldn't have paid. And had this contract then been performed to the end without a hurricane, and Dr. Marlowe is then suing my client for breach of contract, number one, he never paid for the work. So he would have been in court saying, I had to pay Mr. Archer X dollars. Mr. Flint never quoted me what the work was going to be, but I should recover something from Mr. Flint. Well, if Mr. Flint was going to quote $5,000, then Dr. Marlowe has no damages at all. If Mr. Flint was going to quote $10,000, Dr. Marlowe came out better. Because that material issue, that material essential element of a contract was not existing, even if there was a meeting of the minds that the work was going to be done, it couldn't be an enforceable meeting of the minds because it lacked that key element. So that's the easy way to get rid of the whole modification. The second set of facts that I discussed, the facts that Dr. Marlowe indicated himself that he wasn't impressing upon the contract, is also dispositive. We can go with either an explicit agreement or an implied agreement. And the implication in this case from the facts and from the actions of the client simply don't show that there was an implied agreement that was working for these gentlemen at that point. And then lastly, when I said it's all about the hurricane, that's exactly what it's all about. Had the hurricane not come through, and Dr. Marlowe, as I said, sued at some point later on to do this work, we would have been in those circumstances that I just discussed. Had the parties even agreed to do this work, and let's say they agreed to do the work, and the hurricane came through the next day before the work could be completed, the damage would have been destroyed, the dock would have been destroyed. My client still would have been able to recover because the damages from hurricanes are not warranted under the contract. He didn't have time to put in the cross bolts. It would have just been an unfortunate set of circumstances where a hurricane came through in the middle of the progress of the case or the work and destroyed the structure, and an unfortunate set of circumstances would have ensued, as I said. But it wouldn't have been a breach of my client's obligation because, again, the set of facts were we have no time frame for this to be completed. When the oral contract came up, or the request for the contract came up through the email, there was no completion date set. So who's to say that they had even breached at that point when the hurricane came through? And I do take issue with Mr. Pelletti's characterization of the email, and you can find it on page 273, 269-ish. All my client initially said was, I will include what you're asking, which is stringer bolts. That was the extent of what he's saying. His characterization at trial was, what I meant was, I will include it in the contract. I'm going to get back with him on a price on this, and we're going to negotiate at that point. We will have a binding contract if and when he accepts what I come back with.
Under this contract, when other, what's any other instance where the two of them negotiated on price for a change order?
Well, the two change orders were correct, and Mr. Pelletti said there was the extension of the pier, 220 by 20 feet to 220 feet. The pier was quoted originally as at a linear price. So that's factored into the contract. When you ask for 20 more feet, the price is already in there.
He asked for 20 more feet. Your client said, I'll do it.
I'll do it. And he billed according to the same linear price factor.
And what price negotiation occurred?
I don't think there was any at that point. I think it was simply the contract says we're building this at 200 feet or blank dollars per foot, and I can't remember that off the top of my head.
Okay.
If you want 220 feet, it's going to be the same
so
price.
So in terms of these parties' course of dealing, when is there any other evidence with regard to their course of dealing that they negotiated the price for a change?
The other time, Justice Bams, was that when the jet skis were brought up, the jet ski lifts, because they were not a part of the original contract, and then my client did produce a written addendum, and at that point, or change order, whatever they called it. At that point, everybody signed off on that, the jet skis will be X number of dollars.
Did they negotiate the price for that?
That has not been a part of evidence, Judge. I think my client made a proposal. Dr. Marlowe accepted the proposal, and so I would say that constitutes a negotiation.
Did
it
he
wasn't
do
a
it,
back and forth.
I'm sorry. Did he do it before or after the work was completed, the signed-off addendum? Was it submitted as a bill after the work was done?
That I don't know. That has never really been an issue in the case, whether or not the work was done before the invoice was submitted for the work. Is that what your question is?
Correct.
I don't remember that coming up, and I wouldn't be able to tell you honestly how that facts because I haven't asked my client that question specifically. It just hasn't been an issue in the case.
And I guess the other question I have is, was there an agreement as to the price for the lift before the work was done? Do you know whether that's...
I don't know that either. I would make an assumption that the invoice was submitted, but that would be nothing more than an assumption. The work performed after that, but it would simply be an assumption. I don't think that ever came down. The more compelling part of the case is, even if the trial judge had ruled that there was, as the justices have pointed out, the damages in this case are just not there to award anything for Dr. Marlowe. And the assumption that he would have suffered less damage is one that was the subject of the whole reason for the way the engineer did these drawings. My client's position, as he stated at trial, is that if I'm going to leave my clients with a structure that we all know is susceptible to damage from rising tide and storms, my engineers and my course of dealing is to nail this structure together. The alternative way of cross-bolting presents possible damages in themselves, which then the whole structure, rather than being able to give away through the nails, is going to rise with the tide. So we're left with the lesser of two evils. Do you want to resink pilings and have to mobilize a barge and the crane and the pounding? Or do you want to go to Home Depot, buy yourself some extra boards that you yourself can cut and nail down? My client's particular way of doing business is to leave his clients with the ability to go back and buy more boards rather than having to come out and remobilize his equipment to sink pilings. So had you accepted the position that these damages were caused because the cross bolts weren't in there, that would have raised the secondary examination by whatever expert was going to come in to make that to say, well, can you say that this whole piling wouldn't have lifted up as opposed to these boards separating? And if so, what would have been the cost for repairing that damage?
May I ask a question? Your client got a judgment for $14,000.
Yes, ma'am.
Today he has mentioned Horton. Was that part of the argument at the court below that you were not entitled to cross-claim, sue for damages because you were the first breaching party? Is that part of the argument?
At trial, it was simply an offset for our claim of the $14,790 that my client is owed. And that amount is not in dispute. He referred to the General District Court ruling, which is, if you read that ruling, the judge said that my client shouldn't be awarded any damages for work that he had not completed. And that was just a misunderstanding of the facts, I think, from that judge. My client completed all the work that this $14,790 represents. The only uncompleted work was because a neighbor complained there was supposed to be a structure on top of the boat lift. You may know when neighbors complain about that ruining their their view and so forth, you have to delay that until you can get a ruling on it. So they didn't complete that, but my client backed out that price. So the $14,790 is properly owed for all the work that was completed pursuant to the contract. The arguments relative to the damages suffering were simply argued as an offset to that claim.
Maybe I wasn't clear. He argued Horton from the podium. My question is, did he argue to the trial court that you couldn't even bring this claim against him because you were the first breaching party?
No, ma'am. The only place that's mentioned, I think, is in the trial, is in the general district court judge ruling. It wasn't mentioned at trial in the circuit court, and it wasn't argued at the trial in the circuit court. Judges, that would conclude my remarks on this case. I ask you to affirm the ruling of the circuit court and the time frame that I have constructed.
All right, thank you. Court is adjourned.
All rise.